Coming up on Golf Today, world number one meets the media at Colonial after reestablishing his dominance at the PGA at Quail Hollow. Quick turnaround for Scotty. Is he ready to rumble in his native Texas? Find out next on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Big day in college golf as a national champion will be crowned at La Costa. You can watch it here in a couple of hours, 6 p.m. Eastern time. Stanford or Northwestern, who you got? Put up your dukes and let's get down to it. This is Golf Today. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week magazine, Stanford, Northwestern, two fantastic academic schools showing they got pretty good golf teams as well.
We got a lot of good golf this week, actually. The guy who just won a major took all of a couple of days off before Scottie Scheffler gets back to work this week. At Colonial, the LPGA tours in Mexico, there's a senior major going on as well. The oldest one ever to be contested. The first 2 years of the senior PGA played at Augusta National.
That is correct. And how about Scottie? I mean, he's just absolutely tireless. He just keeps on going. Rory had the early part of the calendar. Now we got Scottie. A little bit of a tug of war, I would say.
Scottie seems to like working in Texas as well. He doesn't miss many of those home state events out there, although he was, of course, a New Jersey boy, but
yes,
we forget about that. But at this point, I mean, player of the year race in your mind, is it still? It's not decided.
It's not decided.
I would say Rory McIlroy's got a slight incremental lead
right now.
Not a huge lead.
Two more majors to go, lots of PGA Tour events, the playoffs as well. And I tell you what, that Colonial jacket, one of the one garments in golf that Scottie Scheffler has yet to win. And what a Sunday we did witness in the game as the world number one took home that big Wanamaker trophy at Quail Hollow for his third career major. He's now a 15-time winner on the PGA Tour. And along the way, joined some elite company as the third youngest to win three majors, 15 tour events since World War II. The other two, Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus. And as we said, life rolls on for Scheffler. He's back in action this week, teeing it up in the Charles Schwab Challenge at Colonial Country Club. His first round gets underway tomorrow at 1:45 p.m. Eastern time with defending champ Davis Riley and Daniel Berger as well. With more on the world number one, let's say hello to Rex Hoggard, who joins us now from Colonial. Hey, Rex.
Morning, Damon. I cannot overstate how much momentum Scottie shows up. Some might say a monsoon of momentum when you consider, and this isn't just Sunday at the PGA Championship to get that third major victory on his resume, but considered the week before that in his last regular PGA Tour event, it was in Dallas, just down the road at the Byron Nelson. He only won that by 8 strokes. He had an opportunity to talk with Scottie today, and as expected, it was business as usual.
Well, we've been home for the last couple of days, so it was nice to get home Sunday night. Did a lot of relaxing on Monday and Tuesday, and looking forward to competing this week.
I heard there was a celebration Sunday night. Any highlights?
No, nothing crazy on Sunday. You know, we did all our duties at the golf course and ended up making it home, and yeah, really just a lot of relaxing. We were pretty worn out after last week, obviously. I mean, it's one of those weeks that takes a lot out of you, so it was nice to get home and kind of soak it in and relax for a couple of days, and then we're back out
again today.
I wanted to touch on that, the idea that you mentioned Sunday night, that was probably the most demanding victory, both physically and mentally, of your career. Why was that?
Well, I think it was mostly just the battle that the week kind of entailed for me. You know, I was kind of battling my swing at the beginning of the week, but, you know, like I said, I did such a good job of scoring. Some of the best I've done in my career, I think, and really just battled. And then you look at Sunday as another day where I started off with the lead and lost it and had to, you know, really dig deep to kind of find my swing in the middle of the round, and was able to do so, and was fortunate to be walking away with the trophy.
You've done this a couple times in your career, but what are the keys to coming back after a big victory and playing like this?
Well, I think me personally, I got to have the understanding that my prep work is not going to be what it normally is. You know, I wouldn't be doing as much relaxing on Monday and Tuesday if it was a normal tournament week. But coming off a major, you know, I just got to, obviously my game's in a pretty good spot. And so, just get rest. And I know the golf course well, so there's not a ton of prep work I need to do. I think most of it is just giving my brain a rest, giving the body a rest, and getting prepared for another 72-hole event.
Now, you came close here last year. It's obviously a golf course. It's going to fit your game. What is it about that course you love so much?
I just think it's a really good test of golf. I think it's one of those golf courses where when you're on, you can score really low, and when you're off, the golf course seems so difficult. And I think it's so interesting because on paper, you look at the holes and you think you should shoot so low, and then you come out and start playing, and it's so much harder than you think. And I just love the test that it provides for us. And each year, you see a great champion and a well-deserving one. And so I'm looking forward to coming out and competing this week.
Now, you heard Scotty just say his practice has been limited this week. He didn't even come out to the golf course on Tuesday. Obviously, he was getting some rest after that victory on Sunday. And he is a creature of habit, so that's something to keep an eye on. But I was talking with players on the range this morning about the idea that somehow Scotty might show up rusty or tired. And I had one player that brought up to me really, really quick that the last 3 years here at Colonial, he has finished second, third, second. So I don't think anybody's worrying about Scotty right now. Guys?
I'm definitely not worried about the number one player in the world. I'm a little bit worried about Rex, who thought it was morning. It might be morning in Hawaii, but it is the afternoon. So good afternoon, my friend. We're pleased now to be joined by Andy Weitz, PGA Tour's Chief Marketing and Communications Officer and EVP of Investor Relations. Now, Andy joins us from New York City. You're in town for both the Sports Emmys and the Sports Business Journal Awards. Want to start by congratulating you as the PGA Tour's drone AR technology won the George Wentzel Technical Achievement Award at the Sports Emmys last night. Big night for NBC Sports as well. What's been the buzz about receiving the award?
Oh, well, first, hey, Damon, Eamon, great to be with you guys. Thanks for having me. And that's right. It was a big night for the team last night. Really exciting for our media team to be recognized in this way. For fans out there, this is the bird's eye view that we're able to give you from the drone, where we can actually take that shot off the tee and give you perspective live on where the drive is going, and then great, you know, proportional perspective on where those players end up in the fairway. We think it's a great innovation. We're really excited to see it recognized like this. It's technology we own, patent pending, and we think it's just one example of how we're working to evolve what the broadcast looks like and be responsive to what fans want to see from us. And then to your point, tonight, we're headed over to the SBJ Awards, where we're excited to see TGL, nominated for a breakthrough award, and an important investment. Again, we think a great way to connect with the next generation of PGA Tour fans. It's also fun to see our investors, the Strategic Sports Group, nominated for a deal of the year for their investment in the PGA Tour. So a lot of great stuff going on, a busy time for us.
Well, Andy, speaking of the fans, it was last June when the PGA Tour launched Fan Forward to find out what the fans wanted from the PGA Tour. What have you found out? What do the fans want?
Oh, it's a great question. And for those who aren't familiar, Fan Forward is really the single largest outreach the tour has ever done to better understand the voice of the fan and what they expect from us, how we should evolve. And so over 50,000 respondents in the last 9 months, Damon, and really some key themes cut through for us. They want to see more live golf per minute, which is an obvious one for our core fans. And we'll talk a little bit, if you'd like, about how we're working to declutter the broadcast and bring more live golf shots to them. Secondly, they want more drama on every hole. They're telling us they want to understand risk-reward and how those top players make decisions, especially our fans who aspire to put themselves in a similar setting when they're out on the course on the weekend. They also want to better understand our players. They said, make them more relatable. Help us understand their personalities. So when we engage and follow them, we understand what makes them tick. And then finally, in the course of a long regular season, they're telling, make sure every event has a purpose. You know, help us understand when to tune in and the relationship, if you will, between full field events and signature events and how we create playoff-like bubbles in the middle of the season to really bring more drama to our fans. So those four things cut through. And as a result, we're focused on broadcast enhancements, you know, competition adjustments, which we've made some news on this year, as well as looking at how we support our players from a content perspective so they can reach more fans through social media. And finally, those on-site experience changes that make the whole family want to come out and be a part of every PGA Tour event.
It's not a positive there, Andy. What inspired the tour to go down this fan-forward road? I mean, was there a little bit of catch-up being played in the sense that there was a perception that the tour had spent the previous 2-3 years perhaps focused a lot on what players wanted and what players needed, given the threat from LIV, and that it was time to actually turn the lens a little bit more towards what the fans wanted?
Well, I really think it's about you can make better decisions when you have data in your hands, Eamon. And we wanted to find a North Star, a way to set priorities that helped us evolve in a way that connected with our fans. You know, we can't take for granted that the next generation of fans will just grow into being core PGA Tour fans. There's a lot of things competing for their time. So we wanted to go out and systematically ask them, you know, what they wanted to see from us. And listen, other sports have done this. I think Major League Baseball is a great example. And they found a lot of interesting things that helped them drive really constructive change in their sport. And in terms of our players, our focus is always on our players. If we have the relationship between fans and players working, everything else falls into place.
Speaking of gathering data, the tour is wrapping up this distance measuring device experiment, which is part of a plan to try to educate players more, I guess, about the speed of play and to build a plan going forward. We've talked about that a lot on this show, Andy, and including with some of your members. And a certain theme emerges, which is that you guys know who the slow players are. It's the same guys every week. And obviously there's weather or course conditions apply on occasion, but it is generally the same offenders all the time. Why not just target those guys, or why do you need more data when it comes to slow play?
Well, we're attacking it from every angle, right? And what we announced earlier this year is that we want to understand, first of all, if there's anything we can do from a technology and tool perspective to cut down on time between shots. And that's why you saw us test range finders in the way you just talked about. And that test just wrapped up, I think just last week, actually. We had 6 events over a 4-week period, and now we're studying those findings. I will tell you that the feedback from players, especially on our pathways, has been, yes, we want more of this. It just feels natural. And I think it feels, again, back to the fan, natural to them too. It's what they use on the course. So no reason potentially not to bring that into something that could be used at scale by PGA Tour professionals. So we'll look at that. Secondly, we're testing penalty policies, which begins to go to your question, I think, Eamon. And you saw us on pathways, especially on the Korn Ferry Tour and PGA Tour Americas, actually decrease the number of warnings. If a player's behind time and has a bad time, they're going more quickly to a stroke penalty. And you saw that happen down in Peru to Hunter Wolcott. He actually was assessed a stroke penalty for a bad time, and he went forward to win the tournament. I mean, he accepted the policy, he agreed with the bad time, and he recovered and ended up, you know, in the winner's circle, which is what we love to see. And then the third thing we've talked about is maybe a little bit more shared accountability. So could we begin to share some of these statistics? And you might see us experiment with sharing them amongst players first, because right now, for instance, on our app, a player can see their time, but they can't see, you know, their fellow members. So perhaps that's one way we begin to more, you know, insert more transparency into the process. We could also look at stroke time or total time per course. And by that, I mean, how long should it take to play a particular course? And then finally, we could look at average stroke time by player. And all those things are on the table, and we look forward to sharing more in the weeks ahead. I think you'll see more testing in the 2025 season.
I'm all for assessing stroke penalties, Andy, and I certainly thought it was a good sign when the PGA Tour Americas did that, certainly to a guy who was actually in contention for the tournament. I guess my question to you is, when is that going to be applied to somebody who actually has leverage? When is that going to be applied to a player on the PGA Tour, on the biggest stage of all?
Well, listen, Eamon, I think in a way, you kind of answered your own question. It's notable that we were testing it on pathways, so totally appropriate that we would be looking at the impact and effectively our minor leagues before we brought it to the majors, if you will. And to your point, meaningful that this was a leader who had a bad time and was assessed a stroke penalty. So it was a fair application of the new rule, and it was handled perfectly by our rules team and accepted by the player. And I think what's important is that we got to see the rest of the membership watch that. And you're exactly right. We got to start by testing at that level. We got to learn from it. And I think your question is a good one. And I think you'll see us take this all seriously, you know, as we look into the fall season and potentially into 2026. But what I'd stress is, and what's so great about the tour and our relationship with the players right now, is this will be done in collaboration through our Player Advisory Council. This will be something that many of them have pushed for. They'll get to see the data. We'll make a decision together about the timing. That said, we're excited to take some of these learnings and apply them on the PGA Tour in the future.
Speaking of leaders, Justin Thomas has been a leader in talking about opening up access, better relations with players and broadcast partners, which I loved seeing. But we've also had some notable moments in Colin Morikawa at Bay Hill, Rory McIlroy at the PGA not wanting to talk to the media, understand, upset about how they played. Difficult spot to be in, no doubt. But what is the tour stance on the player obligations to the media?
You know, it's an important discussion. I'm glad you've raised it. And I think it all starts back with the fans. I know that our players want to connect with fans. They want to allow them a window in to what it takes to win at the highest level. And they want to humanize that moment when potentially they come up short. And I know that our partners in the media want to help tell that story at scale. It's good for everybody involved. I think to the examples you gave, and it's important not to single out any one player, there are moments when players decide they need to step back. But I'd say on balance, and that's a key word here, I think, balance, our players are offering more access than ever before. If you look at the pre-round interviews they're doing, the special segments they're doing with some of your colleagues at the Golf Channel, in addition to the walk and talks, I think our fans are getting closer. And I agree with you. We need to look at the right way to strike that balance post-round. And it's definitely a discussion we'll continue to have.
You know, Andy, Lucas Glover came on this show and talked about the Tour Championship. And he said bluntly he doesn't think that playoffs in golf work. He said if they did, we wouldn't have had to change the system every few years. Can you give the fans something to chew on in terms of how the season will wrap up in a way that seems satisfying for the fans and the viewers and the players competing in the FedEx Cup playoffs?
I love it. It's a great question, Damon. And I might point out that it's not every few years. I think our team has done a great job of being responsive and learning from the FedEx point race and kind of changing the levels of points over time to really dial in the outcomes we want. But we're not done. It's been publicly reported that we're taking a hard look at the Tour Championship format. And to your point, we want to make sure our core fans are engaged by, you know, that final stretch of the season. And we want to honor the FedEx Cup, something that a generation of players have grown up now saying they want to hoist that ultimate prize. And of course, we want to do it in a way that's engaging to casual fans. You know, what they call the stick and ball fans, the basketball, the football, the baseball fans. And so we're looking hard at a format that honors the game, creates a more straight up competition, and ultimately is a fair test. And I think what's important here is our players are telling us they want balance. They want balance between recognizing a great regular season and the consistent excellence it takes to finish at the top of the FedEx Cup race. And they like the idea of more volatility and potentially playing more straight up for an outcome at the end of the season that has a true winner hoisting the cup in a singular kind of way at the end of the season. So we're working hard on that. Lots of great conversations with our player advisory council. And I think you should look for news in the weeks ahead.
Would you care to share any of the details of that, Andy, since you're here?
You know, I'm sorry, Eamon, you're breaking up. Now, I'm not going to be breaking any news today, but I do welcome the opportunity to give our fans an update because, again, back to fan forward and that notion of fan research, it all starts with their voice. And we're trying to really calibrate the future of the PGA Tour Championship based on a combination of what fans tell us they expect from a culminating event and what players tell us honors the legacy and heritage of the FedEx Cup itself. We really like where we're headed.
Well, let me try another question that I know you're not actually going to give me any details on either, Andy, which is the CEO search for PGA Tour Enterprises. It's been reported that there are a number of candidates in the mix. What's the timeline on what that search is?
Well, Eamon, in all fairness, the day we announced the CEO search, I came on Golf Channel and talked with one of your colleagues about it. Mm-hmm. From the beginning, we've been super transparent about how excited we are about this development. I think it's totally consistent with the way the tour is evolving. You talked about momentum. A lot of people are talking about us being on the right track. I think the CEO search is about how we go further, faster. And ultimately, when you raise $1.5 billion in growth capital, you want to make sure you're bringing capabilities in that can, you know, steer us forward. It's a new chapter for the tour, and it means new skills. And the commissioner has been at the forefront of that. He's part of our search committee. We have a phenomenal search committee led by Arthur Blank, owner of the Atlanta Falcons, and a number of sports teams, including the Atlanta Drive and TGL. Sam Kennedy, who is the president of the Red Sox, as well as Joe Gorder, the chairman of both our boards. And of course, Tiger Woods at the table, helping with the interview process. So I don't think it's appropriate to put a timeline other than to say it's ongoing. And I think what's been most notable is the interest from across the world of sports and entertainment. It looks like there's a great slate of candidates really interested in being a part of this next chapter at the tour.
Andy, I want to ask you about something inside the ropes. Rory and Scotty have been shining stars this season, almost carrying the tour on their shoulders with their play. But at the same time, a number of players, Erik van Rooyen, Lucas Glover, just to name two, have said that the tour is becoming a little too exclusive, down to 100 cards, too much emphasis on the signature events. I guess my question is, can both things be true at the same time?
I think they can. I mean, Damon, I've used the word balance a lot in the course of our conversation today. And, you know, the decision to take cards down to 100, that field size and eligibility process that we went through was player-led. And we spent better part of a year you know, studying it. We modeled it. We had players in the driver's seat, you know, and weighing the pros and cons. And ultimately, for a variety of reasons, we decided that the reduction in cards was the right answer for today's tour. And, you know, to where you started your question, I do think it's been a notable year with Scotty and Rory battling it out, but so many great storylines. You know, Russell Henley chipping in to beat Colin. Hideki starting the season with his win at the Century in Hawaii. And then you see some folks who've been on the tour for a while, like Joe Highsmith, stepping up and winning in dramatic fashion. I think what's important here is, if you want to watch golf with meaning, played on iconic courses by the world's best players, you're watching the PGA Tour.
On the subject, staying with Rory and Scotty, Andy, they were also in the news last week because their drivers failed testing at the PGA Championship. That's a mundane thing. It happens every week in this game. It happened under a different entity last week. Most weeks the testing is conducted under your entity. Because it is mundane, it's not a surprise to the rest of us, but there are a lot of bad faith actors out there who tried to pretend that there was something nefarious going on here. In the interest of the transparency that you're talking about, why doesn't the tour make that kind of information public on a week-to-week basis? Because it is generally kind of meaningless.
You know, Eamon, it's a good question. I think, like a lot of testing that occurs across the world of sports, it's done in a confidential, private, you know, manner for this very reason, because it could be misinterpreted if it was taken out of context, which respectfully I think occurred in these cases. As you alluded to, this is something that our rules team does on a regular basis. They just want to make sure that we have conforming clubs. And what that means basically is we're keeping the equipment manufacturers in check. We're working within a certain set of limitations, because when you're hitting that ball that many times, being practiced around the course with your favorite club, over a period of months, you begin to wear away at that face. And just like beating a drum, it begins to bend that metal. And so all we want to do on the margin is make sure that everyone is within the limits. And the fact that it became a story is unfortunate. And I don't know that that kind of transparency actually helps, because in this moment, I think what it's demonstrated is it takes on a life of its own. And it's a confidential process that's been successful for many years. And I think we intend to continue it in that manner.
Andy, toward the end of the last year, about the time it was announced that the PGA Tour was looking for a CEO, there was a lot of momentum, at least smoke and some noise and rumors about a potential deal between the PGA Tour and the PIF. Here we are in the middle of spring, heading towards another summer. Is there any update on the negotiations between the two sides?
Well, you guys, I'm not counting the minutes and seconds, but I think it is notable that we've made it to this point in the conversation without getting to the deal and where we stand. I think it speaks to, you know, the way the tour is focused on the things we can control and the news we're making through broadcast innovation, competition adjustments, like I talked about, the player content, the onside experience, all these things that we can control. I have no new news to share in terms of the negotiations with the Public Investment Fund, other than to say we're fully focused on delivering for our fans, and we know they want to see the best players in the world playing together more often. We share that desire, and we're leaning in. Ultimately, we're doing everything we can to control the outcome, and we're doing our best to update people along the way, but nothing more to share today.
Well, it has been 90 days since that White House meeting involving the Public Investment Fund and Commissioner Monahan. There is an anniversary fast approaching, the second anniversary of June 2nd. Is there any internal dynamic at the tour that would suggest that at some point, perhaps by June 6th, you need to set some kind of clarity that you're either following your own momentum or you're going to continue conversations that don't really appear to be going anywhere?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the way we look at it is we're focused on delivering for the fans and we want to keep our options open, but you're exactly right. It's been put differently by different people that ultimately it takes, you know, a common set of engagement from all involved to get to an outcome. In terms of dates, I think we're focused on this weekend, you know, the Charles Schwab Challenge in a great field with Scotty and Jordan, hometown heroes, alongside Ricky and other fan favorites. Next weekend at Jack's Place, the Memorial presented by Workday, a phenomenal field, and then, you know, on to the RBC Canadian Open. And those are the dates that matter to us, because delivering that great fan experience, when we get that right, it works for everybody. You know, you see the kind of investment surging that we have from our partners. You see the fan engagement that I talked about going up year over year. And ultimately, you see players more aligned than ever before. So again, focus on what we can control, keep our options open, and stay focused on the important stuff.
Andy, listen, we so appreciate your time. Know you're very busy. You know, The Outsiders is a terrific show. If you got some time in the city, Pacers, Knicks at the Garden as well. Game one tonight, but I know you got lots going on. We look forward to seeing you at a green grass tournament sometime down the road this summer.
Great to be with you guys. Damon, thanks for the Chamber of Commerce recommendations. I'll do my best to check those boxes. And I hope to make it out to you guys in person next time. As always, thanks for the opportunity.
You got it. There he is, Andy Weitz with the PGA Tour. I tell you, that was fascinating to catch up with him, kind of find out what his mind is, where the tour is at this point. It's been a fantastic season. There's been a lot of different winners, storylines, but the big names have come to the fore, and the tour's obviously trying to engage with the fans and find out what the fans want. But there is a lot going on and still a lot of uncertainty as well.
There is, but I think they've found traction in a couple of key areas, which is certainly the fan engagement has increased, and the sponsors as well. Mm. You know, if you go back a year ago, the conversation was very much about the fear of sponsors drifting away from the tour. And they have signed a lot of sponsor deals over the course of the last 6 months that suggest that the sponsors aren't as concerned as people might have thought they were a year ago. And I do think that there is a culture shift here in terms of focusing on the fan, because this is an organization that has historically focused way more on its members than it has ever focused on its fans, and particularly in the last few years when effectively its own members held the tour ransom. And now I think the realization is that the product is somewhat stabilized. Now it's actually time to stabilize the audience of that product, which hasn't necessarily had the focus that it's deserved over the last couple of years, but it's certainly getting it now.
Stabilizing the audience, I think, is going to be huge going forward, especially with the trajectory of purses. It's a high number we're talking about, and some of the players are concerned. Is it sustainable? Will the sponsors stay? Will they be there 5 years from now with the trajectory that the purses are on without potentially additional funds coming into PGA Tour enterprises?
And then the flip side of that, of course, is what's the ask of the players? What have they been asked for? They've been given more.
Yeah.
But what more are they given? Because we see a reluctance even to commit to any kind of obligations in terms of that certain events are mandatory or that talking to the media after a round is mandatory. The players haven't actually given up anything. They've gotten a lot. They haven't actually given up very much at all. And I think that's ultimately the reckoning that has to come with the private equity investors down the road, is when you start to arrive at what the ideal, streamlined, engaging product is, it is going to demand an ask of the players somewhere along the line. And that's going to be an interesting one to watch.
Lots of questions still to be answered in 2025. You know what the fans want in Texas? They want some Jordan Spieth. A little autograph, a little FaceTime with the three-time major champ and Texas legend. Meeting the people, the youngins, at Colonial.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
We're back on Golf Today. Davis Riley is this week's defending champion at Colonial. Last year, he beat Keegan Bradley and Scottie Scheffler by 5 shots. That was his first individual victory on the PGA Tour. He'd won the Zurich Classic the year earlier with Nick Hardy. It's his only top 10 finish of the season, though, but he's finding some form this year. He's coming off a T2 finish at the PGA Championship last week. And Rex Hoggard caught up with Davis Riley today.
Davis, I want to get into coming back, being the defending champion here, but I want to go back to last week. Really good week in a major championship, by far your best finish. What did you learn from that?
Yeah, it was nice. Like you said, it was my first time probably being in the last, you know, couple groups of a major. But yeah, it was nice to get up there, get the feels, see how I handled it. And I was super proud of the way I handled it. Unfortunately, I got, you know, I made a big number on 7 that kind of kicked me out of it a little bit from having a realistic shot of winning. But yeah, finished really strong to make a really good week out of it. And yeah, I was happy to be runner up and obviously happy to be back here at a place that I really like.
Talked a lot over the last couple of days about what it's like to go up against Scottie when he seems to be in that kind of form. When you looked up at the leaderboard and saw what he was doing, what goes through your mind?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's the number one player in the world, and you know it's going to be a tough battle anytime he's up there. So you know you got to bring your best stuff, and you can't really let up. But at the end of the day, you can only control what you can control. So I just try to play the best golf I can and hope it's good enough at the end of the day.
Go back to last year when you had such a dominant performance. When you open your week with rounds of 66, 64, 66, does it almost feel surreal to you? And how do you continue to put the pressure on?
Yeah, I'm really comfortable around this place. You know, my rookie year, I was up there. I actually had the lead with 6 or 7 holes to go, and I think Sam Burns ended up winning that year. And so I was familiar how the place played late in the afternoon. This place can change a lot from morning to afternoon, so I was familiar with how those last final groups played. And then obviously last year, getting paired with Scotty in the final round, I knew it was going to be a tough battle, even though I had a couple-shot lead. And yeah, just played really solid golf, and thankfully I was able to hold them off by you know, quite a few there at the end.
You mentioned your record on this golf course. Why do you think you play so well here?
I think it just gives me a lot of, takes me back to the course I grew up on. A lot of similarities, Bermuda fairways, thick Bermuda rough, firm greens. So yeah, I think I'm just really accustomed to it. I grew up playing on a course very similar to this. So I think it has a lot of similarities, and that just brings out a pretty good comfort level for me.
Scottie Scheffler is continuing his run on the top of the men's professional game. His 5-stroke victory on Sunday at the PGA Championship was the largest margin in that major since Rory McIlroy won by 8. That was back in 2012. And Scottie Scheffler, now, of course, a 3-time major champion. And here is the championship season and how it's shaking out. Rory McIlroy, of course, taking down the players in that playoff over JJ Spaun. Won the Masters last month. Scottie's got this one. So we've 3 down, 2 left to go with the US Open coming up in a couple of weeks at Oakmont Country Club. And then the Open Championship at Royal Portrush. And earlier today, Scottie Scheffler assessed his most current challenge, which is a Colonial, when he talked with the media.
I just feel like it's a unique challenge that we see on the PGA Tour. You know, it's, we don't play Bermuda grass very often, and we don't play golf courses like this very often. So I like the challenge of more of an old school design. And you know, I think it's just a place that hasn't changed much over the years, and it continues to test us, and I'm looking forward to trying to battle this place again this year.
After your 2 previous major wins, you were off the week after the 22 Masters, and you won the week after 24. I was just wondering what it was like to play the week after winning a major. Is there any feeling, like, any sense that you're playing with house money?
I mean, every tournament I try to treat differently. I mean, coming off a major win, I mean, obviously there's a lot of emotion and stuff that comes with, you know, winning that golf tournament. But at the end of the day, I didn't just show up here to Fort Worth to just walk around and celebrate last week. I mean, I'm here for a reason, and that's not to just play, you know, a couple ceremonious rounds and then ride off in the sunset. You know, I'm here for a reason, and that's to compete. My prep work for this tournament will obviously be a bit different than it normally is for an event. You know, I didn't really do much yesterday or the day before. You know, yesterday I went to the gym and kind of got back doing that stuff a little bit, but this is my first time on the course, and today I'm just playing 9 holes and getting out of here. I'm not doing my normal practice routine just because I need to focus more on rest than I do getting prepared for the course. You know, fortunately, this is a golf course that I've been around numerous times, and you know, today I got a good feel for the speed of the green, hit a couple of bunker shots, hit some chips out of the rough, but outside of that, you know, I just need to get my brain and body rest to prepare for another event.
Have you wondered at all personally in the last 2 years, because you've been on a heck of a run here, if you'd still have the same achievements, had everybody from the other tour been in all the tournaments that you've been playing in? Have you ever thought, I wonder if I'd still finish, would I still be number 1 or 2 or any of those things, had Bryce and Brooks and those guys been with you consistently throughout this entire duration?
Do I think that some of the results would have changed?
Yeah.
Who knows? You know, I mean, I only get to compete against those guys 4 times a year, and, you know, that was their choice, not mine. And so at the end of the day, you know, I'm here competing and doing the best I can, and that kind of stuff, what's the point of me thinking about, you know? I mean, there's really absolutely no point to that. You know, we get 4 chances to compete against them, and, you know, last week went well, and, you know, I'll get another chance here in a few weeks.
Man, I wonder what Scotty really wanted to say in an answer to that question about the guys who left the PGA Tour. Anyway, from one Longhorn to the next, Jordan Spieth is a member of the men's golf team at Texas during the 2011-12 season before turning professional. And during that short stint as a Longhorn, Spieth was a consensus first-team All-American, finalist for the Ben Hogan Award as the National Player of the Year, while leading Texas to the 2012 national title. Let me take you back to 2016 Colonial. Jordan Spieth used an impressive back 9 to win for the first time in his home state to make those 30-footers look so easy. Made 3 straight birdies after making the turn, and 3 straight to finish his round as well, clearing the field by 3 shots. One of 2 victories, by the way, for Jordan Spieth that season. His record at Colonial, I'd say it's pretty good. 12 starts, a victory, 3 runner-up finishes, 8 top 10s, and only 1 missed cut. That came a couple of years ago. He's on the golf course gearing up for tomorrow. And Eamon, coming off that missed cut, of course, had the chance to complete the career Grand Slam. Hasn't won a golf tournament in 3 years now. Has only won twice since 2017. I talked to him at Bolero, a little impatient, trying to get things back together post-wrist surgery.
Yeah, maybe this is the kind of place that can give him a spark, but I feel as though we say that a lot about Jordan Spieth. He does go to a lot of places where he does have a good playing record. He just doesn't necessarily have a good playing record recently. And his form really hasn't been much this year at all. He did finish 4th in the CJ Cup Byron Nelson, but otherwise it's been a pretty mediocre year for Jordan Spieth. You got to go back to, you know, the Cognizant Classic and the Palm Beaches and Phoenix for him to have top 10 finishes. And he's just not playing at the level that we're accustomed to seeing him. But what is that level now? Because we still judge Jordan Spieth against what we saw in those golden years from, say, 2014, 2015 through 2017. And he's become a lot more complicated player since then. The driver went away. Word now the driver is something of a weapon. The putter, which was a weapon, kind of went a little bit wayward. Seems to be somewhat stabilized at the moment. Not particularly good, but not as bad as it had been for a couple of years. And then obviously the wrist surgery that he had late last year after the playoffs that knocked him out for a number of months. And he has talked about how he's slowly working his way back from that he needs to kind of loosen up that hand in the morning, that he feels as though he's, you know, 70 years old when he wakes up in the morning and arthritic in the hand. So that can't be an easy process to get from that kind of recovery, which he said could take a year plus, into the kind of comfort zone to play the kind of golf he expects of himself. We just haven't seen that kind of golf from him all that much recently.
And players used to measure themselves against Jordan Spieth during those golden years, as you mentioned. Now he says he measures himself against Scottie Scheffler, someone who's in his backyard, someone who he plays practice rounds with, and he says he is motivated by what Scottie Scheffler has done and doesn't feel that he's that far away from being the type of player that he wants to be and that his legion of fans expect him to be.
Well, we've certainly seen Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas talk about how they've been motivated by the performances of each other. So Jordan Spieth, just the latest in that list. Well, let's take a little stroll down Amnesia Lane here. Corey Pavin, he was the stash in golf long before Johnson Wagner had won. He's making his 33rd start in the Charles Schwab Challenge. He won the title way back when, 1985, and again in 1996. He's made 25 cuts. He last played here back in 2015. And he's not the only sexagenarian in the field. David Frost, 65, also is making his 28th start in this tournament. He won back in 1997, which was the last one played before Ben Hogan died, who was, of course, so associated with this event. He beat Faxon and David Ogren by 2 strokes. Tiger Woods was 3 back.
About another 65-year-old, Olin Brown, making his 15th start in the Charles Schwab Challenge, made 5 cuts with a win back in 1999. That year, he won by a shot over 5 players after shooting weekend rounds of 66-66. So with more on these 3 65-year-olds in the field, and 65 doesn't seem that far away as it used to be, let's welcome back Rex Hoggard.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I think all of us know that on the PGA Tour, membership has gotten younger and younger over the last couple of years. Just consider, in this week's field, there's a 19-year-old that's making his 6th start just of this season. There's also a 2-time winner in this field who would have been a junior in college right now had those victories not changed his career path. Now, contrast that with, as you just pointed out, Corey Pavin and Olin Brown, 2 65-year-old former champions here who are making what will likely be a generational swan song on a golf course where they have both made so much history.
I live pretty close, and Congressional is a tough course, big, long golf course, and with the Senior Open or Senior PGA there this year. So I kind of talked to Eric about it, my caddy, and we thought it'd be fun to come back here and play, and potentially this could be my last PGA Tour event, and I love the place. It's one of my favorite stops, probably my favorite stop, actually. So it's fun to come back here. I know a lot of people, and I can just drive from home and come out here.
What are the memories that come back when you're here? As I said, 2-time winner, so much success.
Well, a lot of good memories, you know, a lot of good shots and a few good putts and, you know, some hold shots here and there and stuff like that. So, you know, it was my second win, the first time I won here. And I won by four. I only made two bogeys during the week. So I'd say that that tournament I had in 85 was probably my best tournament I ever played, actually. You know, all in all, when you look at the big picture.
It's just a wonderful place. First of all, it's one of the top two or three courses that we play all year on this tour. And it's a great kind of feather in my cap to have that jacket and open up my locker and see that it's in there every time I return.
Last time you played here was 2020. What drove you to come back this year?
Well, I hadn't seen the redo. I really wanted to. I was almost going to do it last year. And then I didn't. And I'm getting on now, and I'm ready to step away from golf in general. I want to do it one last time, see it, see how things are, see old friends.
Now, for a little bit more context, you heard Corey Pavin just reference his second victory here at Colonial. That was back in 1996 when he won that week. Last year's champion, Davis Riley, he wasn't even born yet. Guys?
How about that? Love seeing those three 65-year-olds in the field.
We should also point out, Rex, that just before the keyboard warriors get to work, that they're not actually taking a spot from anyone in the field here, right? The field was expanded because of a quirk of how Colonial works to let those former champions play. So they're not denying anyone the chance to make a living.
Absolutely. You look at this field, it's one of the best fields you get all year long. But they do carve out exemptions for the past champions. It's something that's very important to them here at Colonial.
Yeah, it's very old school, just like the golf course itself. Great reporting from Rex Hoggan. We're back on golf today. First Tee Week is a new national brand awareness campaign which aims to promote First Tee's mission of equipping kids with life skills and values through the vehicle of golf. The theme for this year's campaign is Dear Coach. And we're celebrating the coaches who are game changers in their communities. Now, New Orleans Saints defensive end Cam Jordan is a First Tee Phoenix alumnus, selected by the New Orleans Saints in the first round of the 2011 NFL Draft. He's played his entire career in New Orleans and was recently honored by the city, which named May 8th to be Cam Jordan Day. And Cam Jordan joins us now. It's First Tee Week. You're at Colonial. What are you up to specifically at the Charles Schwab Challenge this week?
Man, I've sort of been my First Tee alumni. Was on a panel today. Just talking to a couple kids about what it's like not only being an athlete, but just the overcoming adversities as well as the mentorship that I'm sure First Tee has provided for so many years, from back in Phoenix when I was a part of it to now.
Cam, the focus of this project for the First Tee right now is Dear Coach. Who were some of the coaches that impacted you earlier in your life, and in what way did they impact you?
I mean, first of all, I think my dad was probably my first coach. My mom's probably, you know, was going to take right there. But after my parents, you'd look as far as high school. I had a D-line coach. That was awesome. He was a linebackers coach, D-line coach. Ted Williams was great, as well as, you know, my first true mentor, who I still feel like I can call at any given day, at any given time, is Ron Gould. He was my running back coach at Cal, but he treated me like family, invited me to the house, made sure I got to church on time on Sundays while I was at Cal. And then my D-line coach, Tosh Lupoy. Those guys right there, I'm forever going to be grateful for those two guys right there.
You know, Cam, I covered the league back in the day. Tuesday's usually an off day. Guys, you know, you're off, you can stay at home, maybe you go get treatment, but you're known as the guy who spends Tuesdays at a community center or a school giving back. Why is that something you do throughout your career?
Man, if it's just in me. I feel like I come from a family who's been blessed and given so much, so easy to pour to others. When I first came to New Orleans, my first friends were just regular, normal people. I came in the lockout year back in 2011 when the Saints really couldn't have anything to do with me once I got to New Orleans. So that being said, it felt like the city had adopted me. So it's so easy to give back to a city that has loved me from the time I got there and shown me love since I've gotten there. All I try to do is look at the next generation, see how can I help them. whether it's, you know, visiting these school visits, whether it's starting the Cam Jordan Foundation, where this upcoming, you know, later on this month, we'll be announcing our four recipients of the Cam Jordan Legacy Scholarship Fund. And I mean, sending four kids to in school Louisiana colleges is going to be phenomenal to start off with, and we're going to go from there. All we're trying to do is make our world a little bit better every day.
You're a busy guy, Cam. What's the state of your golf game?
Man, I just played Monday. I'm not going to lie to you. I think I love golf more than golf loves me. But I feel like that's almost everybody's story. I couldn't give you a handicap because I'm only here to play 9 while I'm active. You know, if I have to play 18, fine. But I'm really in that sweet spot of like a 6 to 9 hole guy. You know, I love the driving range more than the golf course loves me. At least there, I could not lose as many balls.
Yeah, Eamon is built in a similar fashion. Well, the state of Texas loves its Jordans. Typically, it's Jordan Spieth, Scottie Scheffler, of course, the world number one. While you're there, might you spend some time to talk to some of the best golfers in the world? Maybe talk about what makes both of you great in your respective endeavors.
Absolutely. I think while I was on a panel for the first tee, I think Scotty had just walked past us as we started up. I was like, well, that was my chance. But maybe later on today, I'll get another chance to see him.
Well, Cam, it's great to visit with you. You're tough to tackle and tough to beat trying to go around the offensive line and get that quarterback, which you do so well on Sundays. Best of luck with your golf game, and thanks for giving back through First Tee, which has meant so much to you.
Absolutely. Hey, it's a driving force. You know, when you start up at 6, 7 years old and you don't know how to swing a club, First Tee program was there. Years later, I'm still trying to figure out how to create that driving force.
Just like the rest of us. Thanks so much, Cam. Little update from La Costa. Now, we saw Northwestern's Ashley Yoon miss the green at 1, so Mega Gane of Stanford is one up through that first hole in the first match of the Division I Women's Golf Championships, coming your way 15 minutes from now. Now, speaking of someone who had an outstanding collegiate career, our own Amanda Blumenhurst played at Duke University, 3-time National Player of the Year. I love saying that. 3-time Golf Stat Award winner, 4-time All-America, 4-time All-ACC honoree, became the first NCAA women's golfer to win 3 National Player of the Year and Golf Stat Awards. And I want to talk about some college accomplishments. Only multiple winner of the Nancy Lopez Award, 07, 08, 09, and the Dinah Shore Trophy, 08 and 09, and led Duke to 2 NCAA championship titles, 3 ACC titles, 12 career individual wins. So great to have Amanda with us on the Golf Today set. She'll be joining me later on Golf Central.
Got a player after
we finally got a player, someone who knows what they're doing with 14 clubs. You know what it's like to go back to back, something Stanford is trying to do for the first time since you did. What is the challenge like?
Well, definitely like Stanford, Duke was the team to beat. And so I do feel, when I look at Stanford, kind of the pressure that they, I'm sure, are feeling. Now, match play is a completely different animal. I felt like we were a little bit more in control when you're playing stroke play to go out and kind of get the job done. You're able to, I mean, in match play in the same way, you stick to your own match, you know, you're just playing the golf course, but there's a little bit more can happen in match play. You know, the players can get hot and all of a sudden the points gets put up on the board that you might not have been expecting. So it was so exciting being at Duke to help them get a three-peat, because my senior year of high school, they had one as well. So I definitely remember that, and it was so much fun. And today with Stanford and Northwestern, it's going to be so entertaining. It's going to be so fun. I mean, obviously on paper, Stanford's the better team, but then you always kind of have to embrace that underdog story. They have almost nothing to lose. They're the Cinderella story, and there's a lot of power in that.
Where does the pressure kick in, Amanda, in terms of, we crowned a national individual champion on Monday. Now is the team component of it. When you were playing, did you feel more pressure in a team setting than you felt as an individual?
You could see that a little bit with Maria Jose Marin, who won the individual title. She went out and lost her match that was very important for Florida State. And there's probably a lot of mental toll, you know, emotional exhaustion. But there is just that extra bit of pressure when it is for your team, when you know that you might be the deciding point for your team to, whether it was advanced to the semifinals, to the finals, or to have them, you know, hoist that trophy at the end. I definitely felt more pressure when you have your teammates, but you hear all the teams, your Stanford talk about it, Northwestern talk about it. It's really a family. You know, you saw Derek Radley with Oregon yesterday embrace the girls and say, you have nothing to hang your hat on. Mm. You had a record-breaking season. I love you all. You are my family. And you can feel that throughout all of the teams.
We see the tears. We see the jumping around, the tears of joy, tears of sadness. David Ford of UNC talked about the van rides that he'll miss in
van
college.
Rides are great.
What do you remember about those times? Just the laughs, the giggles, and the memories you had when you were at Duke.
There are some great pictures of Coach Dan Brooks really looking like he's giving us some great advice. Like, you know, we're analyzing a par three, and we were like, so do you spread the peanut butter on top and then jelly and then peanut butter? Or it'd be like, we were like really in deep conversation, be like, so Cold Stone or McDonald's? You know, it was like, what ice cream spot? And it was always so much fun. And those are, I mean, obviously you're going to always remember NCAA wins or going undefeated in ACCs our first 3 years. Like that, you know, those are very important and very exciting, but it's the relationships you build. Allison Whitaker, who's Sky Golf now, she used to make us sing karaoke Little Mermaid songs on the bus, like wow. To and from. So, you know, it's things like that, no matter how old you get, no matter where your life takes you, you always, you really treasure.
What's been the biggest surprise to you so far this week, Amanda, between either the stroke play portion, the individual, the team? Is there anyone who's either outperformed or didn't perform to the level that you actually expected from them?
I would say outperformed for sure on Northwestern's team. When I look at Deanna Lee, who took down Kiara Romero, who number two ranked collegiate player for Oregon, they both played very well. There's nothing that Romero really didn't make a ton of mistakes, but Deanna, she was ranked 76th. In the college rankings, she really turned it on. And it was so important. Obviously, it was the deciding point. But, you know, some people were saying that she was kind of the sacrifice, like sacrificial point. And she turned that completely around and was
the deciding
point.
And that changes the dynamic for the entire team, right, when they see that happen.
That she's not getting beat 6-5, or, you know, that she's sticking with it and keeps going extra holes. And then also Elise Lee, a freshman, she has gone undefeated. And she is ranked 115th. So the fact that she's also played phenomenally in the quarters and semis and has really come back from a huge deficit, I definitely keep my eye on her as well.
These are two renowned universities of higher learning, great academics, athletics, similarly at Duke. Was there something when you were there on campus with Coach Brooks? You know, Coach K at the time had won 3 national titles. What's it like going to a school where the expectations are high and the students are highly motivated?
I loved it. I loved it. And when I was going on my recruiting trips, that was kind of a feel that you get when you're walking through the campus a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to be also at a school that has a great basketball program or football. Not at Duke at the time while I was there. They've gotten a lot better. But yeah, it makes it that energy on campus as well that's really fun. But there's also a lot of team pride. There's a lot of college pride to take that. My 10-year-old son, Will, he's called Duke by my grandma. I'm like, he wears Duke everywhere he goes. Like, he has fully embraced that. So it's definitely something that is, you know, special, near and dear to my heart, no matter, you know, how many years I am out of college. Mm.
When you look back at it now from all these years later, what's your favorite memory from the NCAA's period?
So I would say our first year when Ohio State hosted, it was pretty much just we ran away with it, not to, you know, blow my own horn. But we really, it was the next year that we played in Daytona that it was much closer. We really had to fight. And I will remember that because that we kind of at night we had to have our team huddle and be like, you know, just coach, be like, you keep doing what you're doing. You guys are meant to be here. You're such a talented group. And so remembering that moment where we really had to trust the other members of our team that they were going to do their job, go out and get it done. But the last putt, the final day, pouring water on everybody and getting really excited.